Welcome. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up first is 42 Arrested in Arizona Sober Living Home Fraud Targeting Native Americans. Charges include manslaughter, by Elise Wild for Native News Online. 42 people were arrested in Arizona this week in 10 separate cases in connection with a nearly $3 billion sober living home fraud that targeted Native Americans and left thousands missing and dead. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays announced their arrest on Wednesday, June 24th, during a press conference. The charges range from fraudulent billing, theft and conspiracy, to vulnerable adult abuse, manslaughter, and negligent homicide. Between 2019 and 2023, thousands of Native Americans in Arizona and as far away as Montana reported being kidnapped, forced into unmarked SUVs and vans under false pretenses, given alcohol and drugs such as fentanyl and methamphetamine, subjected to fraudulent mental health services, held prisoner, and eventually ejected onto the street or dropped off in remote rural areas with no means of transportation. Victims were enrolled in the American Indian Health Program through the state's Medicaid agency, the Arizona Health Care Cost Containment System Access. The homes billed access for patient care in excess of $8,000 per day per patient. In 2018, a congressional hearing attended by an Arizona congressman had already warned about fraudulent sober living homes nationwide, preying on vulnerable individuals seeking addiction treatment. The hearing detailed reports of human trafficking, kickbacks, rapes, house managers trading drugs to residents for sex, and operators exploiting federal laws for profit. Native advocates sounded the alarm on the abuse for years as word spread across Indian country of people disappearing into white vans on reservations. A class action lawsuit filed in 2024 on behalf of thousands of Native people impacted by the fraud claims that the state was made aware of the fraud as early as 2019 and failed to act. The suit alleges that 2,000 people died or are missing as a result of the scheme. The state estimates the fraud cost taxpayers $2.8 billion. At Wednesday's press conference, Mays showed body camera footage of a search warrant executed at the home of a doctor convicted in 2024 in connection with the fraud. The video shows a sprawling estate with luxury vehicles and designer goods, a stark contrast to the bleak conditions in the sober living homes. Today, nearly 180 individuals have been indicted for the fraud, 41 people have been convicted, and 200 cases are still being investigated. While the state is cracking down on fraudsters, the danger remains. Though the state officials say data indicate no fraud is occurring, advocates disagree. Reva Stewart Dene, founder of Turtle Island Woman Warriors, a nonprofit that assists families and victims affected by the scheme, told ABC 15 Arizona that she continues to see sober living home recruiters trying to poach vulnerable Native people. "It's still happening," she said, "and it's going to continue to happen if everyone keeps pointing fingers." Up next, Supreme Court rules mailed ballots postmarked by Election Day must be counted, a win for Native voters, by Elise Wild for Native News Online. A Supreme Court decision issued today protects Native American voters who cast their ballots by mail. In Watson v. Republican National Committee, the court ruled in a 6-3 decision to uphold voters' rights by allowing ballots cast on time to be counted after Election Day, as permitted under state law. The ruling protects Native voters across Indian country who face a litany of barriers to casting their ballots and depend on absentee voting. The majority opinion was written by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who argued that the word election in federal statutes has always meant the act of selecting a candidate, not the receipt of ballots. Plaintiffs argued that the 19th century practice of same-day ballot receipt was constitutionally mandated, but the court countered that practice does not make law. More than half of the states already count absentee ballots postmarked by election day but received afterwards. Native people living on a reservation face disproportionate barriers to voting, including polling places located long distances away, a lack of transportation, and absentee ballots arriving late. In 2024, preliminary turnout in majority Native countries dropped from 53.3% in 2020 to 48.8%, a decline of nearly 10,000 votes. Janie Parrish Dene is the executive director and co-founder of Arizona Native Vote, a Phoenix-based nonprofit aimed at increasing civic engagement in Arizona's tribal communities. Parrish emphasized that the state's remote tribal nations rely on absentee ballots. The SCOTUS ruling upholding state law allowing late arrival mail-in ballots is critical, Parrish told Native News Online. We haven't received much hopeful news from the Supreme Court lately, but this is a good one. A large percentage of voters on Navajo, Hopi, and White Mountain Apache vote by mail. The way our community organizing team sees this decision, one less barrier to worry about for now. Second, we have to pay attention because there will still continue to be attacks on voting, especially mail-in voting, so our folks must be prepared and vote early. Judith LeBronc, Caddo Tribe of Oklahoma, Executive Director of Native Organizers Alliance, agrees. The Supreme Court's decision to uphold counting mail-in ballots received after Election Day is a big win for Native, Black, rural, and all communities whose voting rights have been under such constant attack, LeBlanc said. Now we must continue to organize to ensure Native voters have the necessary access to polls for the 2026 midterm elections. The Native Rights Fund, NARF, and Tori K. Dolan of Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center submitted an amicus brief on behalf of the National Congress of American Indians, Alaska Federation of Natives, and Washington Conservation Action Education Fund in support of the petition in the case. The brief explained that Native communities often lack reliable mail delivery, have fewer postal services, and endure longer mail transit times, especially in Alaska Native communities. Native American Rights Fund senior staff attorney Jacqueline De Leon said communities with fewer resources should not lose their right to vote. Today's decision provides some protection to Native American voters, who should not lose the right to have their vote counted because their communities have less in-person voting opportunities and their mail takes longer to process and deliver than other communities, said De Leon. Ballots cast by election deadlines should not be discarded simply because substandard service or weather delays cause them to arrive after Election Day. Today's ruling defends longstanding protections for Native voters and all Americans who depend on absentee voting. Next up, After 250 Years, Everything Back, Everything Forward, by Native News Online staff. Editor note, this article is part of Native News Online's America 250, a Republic Built on Native Land initiative. The Association on American Indian Affairs has issued the following statement, reflecting on the resilience of Native people and tribal nations over the past 250 years, despite policies designed to separate them from their lands, families, languages, governance systems, and ways of life. The statement examines what Native people and Native nations have endured throughout this history and highlights how Native values can help guide the path forward for future generations. After 250 years, everything back, everything forward. As the United States prepares to celebrate its 250th anniversary, Native nations mark something different: how Native people and their governments have survived the last 250 years. For generations, the United States pursued policies designed to separate Native peoples from the very relationships that sustain them, their lands, families, languages, cultures, governments, and responsibilities to the natural world. Today, many of the crises facing America stem from the same systems of separation. We call for everything back and everything forward as a roadmap to our shared future. For 250 years, federal policy attempted to weaken Native nations by disrupting the relationships that made them strong, separate people from their lands, separate children from their families, separate communities from their languages, separate governments from their authority, separate cultures from their ceremonies and beliefs, separate human beings from the natural world that sustained them. The devastating consequences of these policies remain, yet after centuries of attempted erasure, Native nations remain. More importantly, we remain hopeful. Hope is not naive optimism. It is the decision to continue investing in future generations, despite hardship. That hope is remarkable because the challenges facing Native people are profound. Due to the direct impacts of historic and ongoing U.S. law and policy, Native peoples continue to experience some of the country's most severe disparities in health and well-being, including suicide rates nearly double the national average and devastating impacts from violence, trauma, and adverse childhood experiences. These realities are not historical accidents. They are predictable results of policies that disrupted relationships essential to human flourishing. Yet Native nations have resisted and persisted. The path to healing does not come through further assimilation. It comes through restoration. When Native nations reclaim languages, protect sacred places, restore traditional food, exercise sovereignty, and strengthen cultural lifeways, Native peoples become healthier, stronger, and more resilient. This is the meaning of everything back. It is not a return to the past. It is the restoration of relationships, responsibilities, and systems of knowledge that allowed Native nations to thrive for millennia. And that restoration points towards something larger, everything forward. Everything forward begins with a question. What kind of future are we building? Across the country, people are confronting challenges Native nations have long witnessed and warned about. Environmental destruction, lack of trust in institutions, growing isolation, threats to human rights, and uncertainty about the future. These challenges share a common root, a system that prioritizes extraction over relationship, short-term gain over responsibility, and individual accumulation over collective well-being. Native people have long understood that human beings exist within a web of relationships. Healthy communities depend on healthy land. Healthy economies depend on healthy ecosystems. Future generations depend upon the choices made today. That is why Native nations continue to protect clean water, forests, ecosystems, sacred places, and self-determination. These are not only Native issues, they are human responsibilities. Indigenous teachings have long reminded humanity that financial wealth cannot replace the necessities of life. When the last tree is cut, the last fish is caught, and the last river is polluted, money cannot make hunger go away. Today, that teaching feels less like a warning and more like an observation. Everything forward means carrying these responsibilities into the future for Native nations and for everyone who depends on clean air, clean water, equality, participation in democratic systems, and a livable planet. Supporting Native nations is not charity. It is an investment in a healthier future for all. More than 70 years ago, legal scholar Felix Cohen wrote, "Like the miner's canary, the Indian marks the shift from fresh air to poisonous gas in our political atmosphere, and our treatment of Indians reflects the rise and fall in our democratic faith." His words remain true. When treaty obligations are ignored, the rule of law is weakened. When Native people are excluded from decisions affecting their lands and waters, democracy is weakened. When sacred places and ecosystems are sacrificed for short-term gain, our collective future is weakened. The treatment of Native nations is a measure of the health of America, democracy itself. For generations, Native nations have carried a vision of governance grounded in reciprocity, kinship, stewardship, collective responsibility, and obligations to those yet to come. While modern systems often emphasize individual gain and immediate outcomes, Indigenous governance asks a different question. How will today's decisions affect the next seven generations? Native rights are not separate from human rights or from natural law. They are among the clearest measures of whether a society is committed to justice, accountability, and the collective good. As the United States marks 250 years, America faces a choice. The next 250 years can continue the patterns that produced environmental degradation, inequality, broken relationships, and distrust. Or they can embrace principles Native nations have carried since time immemorial: responsibility, reciprocity, stewardship, and respect for future generations. Native nations are still here. We are still speaking our languages, still protecting our homelands, still exercising our sovereignty, still carrying forward our responsibilities. After 250 years, the question is no longer whether Native nations will survive. The question is whether America is ready to learn from the peoples it once tried to erase. Everything back, everything forward. You're listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, Indigenous-led whale watching tour now offered in Seattle. First Stories of the Salish Sea, a collaboration with Taproot Travel Company and FRS Clipper, took its inaugural voyage on June 16th, offering the first Indigenous-led whale watching tour in Elliott Bay, off the shores of Seattle, rooted in Coast Salish culture and history. By Nika Bartu-Smith for ICT News. Seattle. Walking through Waterfront Park in downtown Seattle along the shore of Elliott Bay in the Puget Sound, Pier 69 has long been home to the iconic whale-watching tours aboard the FRS Clipper. Starting mid-June, every Tuesday through July 21st of this summer, now offers an extra special tour grounded in Indigenous knowledge and storytelling. Some people are really excited about seeing a whale and are also gaining a perspective from our point of view and the naturalist point of view, said Valerie Segrest, citizen of the Muckleshoot Indian Nation and chief executive officer of Taproot Travel Company. This idea of harmonizing wisdom is important, and then when we speak directly to it and you experience it, it can change your heart. It can change your way of thinking, and that's really what we hope to get out of this. Taproot Travel Company is a Native-led organization launched in May that was created to connect people to Indigenous homelands through immersive cultural experiences. The organization began in part from conversations about First Stories of the Salish Sea. The company hopes the tours can help bring non-Indigenous tourists a better understanding of the current and past Indigenous history of the area. For Segrest and her team at Taproot Travel Company, this felt particularly important when thinking about the uptick in tourists during the 2026 FIFA World Cup, as Seattle is one of 16 host cities this summer. And the summer marks the 250th anniversary of the United States. This tour in particular is very timely, Segrest said. The Clipper is doing the good work of really trying to engage meaningfully in collaboration with the Indigenous communities in the course that they represent. And they have such amazing partners that we felt really encouraged to help curate an experience that doesn't only help us share who we are with the world and all these visitors that are here, but to help bring visibility to our history during a very meaningful anniversary for our country. The 250th is a big deal, and we feel that our history has always been told by somebody else, and to be told through our perspective during this time is meaningful and part of our healing journey. First Stories of the Salish Sea Tour. The First Stories of the Salish Sea Tour aboard the FRS Clipper's new Emerald Clipper catamaran was created by Taproot Travel Company and the FRS Clipper. Along with this six-tour experience, Taproot Travel Company also has multiple Seattle-based itineraries and a native business directory. Though Seattle-centric as of right now, the organization does have plans to grow its reach. A lot of the work we do is elevating their understanding of our history, bringing them up to date, because we know that U.S. history does not do that work. And so we're trapped in the 19th century people's paradigms of us, Sigrid said, describing what she hopes to do with the tours that are being curated at Taproot Travel Company. A chance to share traditional knowledge, providing some education around Indigenous history and culture, Taproot Travel Company also ensured that the First Stories of the Salish Sea Tour would be a place to support Indigenous vendors with food and beverage available from vendors such as Fireweed Baking Company, Theos Longhouse Strong Coffee, and Talking Cedar Brewery and Distillery. Sigrist first connected with FRS Clipper during the Native Grown and Gathered Food Expo that she helped produce in October 2025 in Seattle when a group went on a tour of Elliott Bay. A few months later, this led to a conversation about authentic Indigenous representation along Alaska Way in Seattle, the main pedestrian walkway that stretches along Elliott Bay. It reminds me of a story. As the first FRS Clipper cruised through the waters of the Salish Sea during the inaugural tour of four First Stories of the Salish Sea, the sun beaming off the water and highlighting the white tips of the waves, passengers listened as Owen Oliver, Quinault Indian Nation, and Isleta Pueblo shared stories of both past and present. Oliver talked about treaty rights and ongoing tribal fishing throughout Elliott Bay, as he pointed out important historic sites along the shores, such as the historic village sites at Alki Beach and Discovery Park, a site of Indigenous activism. He shared stories about land, animal relatives, and Coast Salish people. He also spoke words in Lushootseed, a Central Coast Salish language. As the Emerald Clipper made its way past Alki Beach, passengers were able to watch a pod of orcas swimming together and surfacing in and out of the water as the boat slowed down. It reminds me of a story, Oliver said, as tour guests looked into the waves to try and spot the orcas. Oliver shared a story from the Tulalip and Sonomish people about how orcas helped to clear the seals as they were eating up all the salmon. Then he shared another story from an intertribal canoe journey a few years ago when a picture went around Facebook showing an orca popping up its head between two canoes as they got ready for the journey. Many elders say that orcas continue to hear our songs, Oliver said. I like to think that as we share our songs about the Salish Sea, that they remember those songs of our ancestors. Passengers were invited to try nettle tea, nettle lemonade, and rose hip mint tea as Elizabeth Campbell talked about many of the medicinal properties offered by plants. Campbell and Sigrist also talked about the diminishing kelp highway, a rich coastal migration route that connects Seattle to Japan. Bullwhip kelp is essential for the ecosystem, providing for sea creatures and helping to diminish the impacts of climate change, according to Campbell. It is also rich in nutrients and an important first food for many coastal Salish tribes. After nearly 4 hours cruising through Elliott Bay and learning about local Indigenous history and culture and hearing stories grounded in place that centered first foods and animal relatives, passengers leaving the Emerald Clipper following the First Stories of the Salish Sea Tour walked away with a whole new perspective of the bay. As we head back, just think about this beautiful landscape and the viewpoints that we've shared today, and just understand how important it is to share these stories and continue to protect these lands and uplift our animal relatives as well, like the orcas and the humpbacks we saw today, Oliver said. This story is co-published by Underscore Native News and ICT, a news partnership that covers Indigenous communities in the Pacific Northwest. In our final story, Maple Leafs select First Nations player first overall in National Hockey League Draft by Sam Lascaris for windspeaker.com. While speaking about one of the best days of his life, being chosen first overall in the National Hockey League NHL Draft June 26th, Gavin McKenna, citizen of the Tarandek-Hawichan First Nation in Yukon, took time to discuss the achievement's possible impact on Indigenous youth. "I think it will show them that anything is possible," McKenna said in his first press conference after being drafted by the Maple Leafs. "I want to make those young kids believe in themselves, and I want to be a good role model for all of them." McKenna becomes just the second Indigenous player to be the top pick in the NHL draft, held annually since 1963. Dale McCourt, a member of the Kitigan Zibi Anishinaabeg First Nation in Quebec, was the top of his class in 1977. McCourt went on to play 553 NHL games. This year's draft, held at the KeyBank Center in Buffalo, was a two-day affair. Round one was held on June 26, and the remaining six rounds were held the following day. McKenna is First Nations through his mother, Crystal. His grandfather, Joe, is a survivor of the Indian residential school system. McKenna, an 18-year-old left winger, was born and raised in the Yukon capital of Whitehorse. He spoke glowingly of his hometown. "I think they're all pretty excited," he said, "of the city's residents. That place has meant the world to me. And there's a big draft watch party in the Yukon right now. So I know a lot of people at home are watching. The support they've given me over the years has been second to none." McKenna has been touted as the possible top pick in this year's draft eligible class since he was 14. He started gaining recognition when he was chosen first all over by the Medicine Hat Tigers in the Western Hockey League Bantam draft in 2022. McKenna played just 16 games in his first year with the Tigers in the 22-23 season, racking up 18 points. The following year, he collected 103 points in 66 games. To prepare himself for the draft, McKenna took his talents south of the border for the 25-26 season, suiting up for the NCAA's Penn State Nittany Lions, where he tested his abilities against older, university-aged players. Draft night added a surprise element to it when NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman said a special guest would introduce the top pick overall for the Maple Leafs, pop superstar Justin Bieber, a lifelong Maple Leafs fan. "It's a special moment for sure," McKenna said upon hearing the singer announced his name. "This is my dream come true, to hug my family and walk up on the stage. To see Justin Bieber, this isn't what I imagined when I was a young kid. It's just so much better." Other Maple Leaf supporters gathered in Buffalo Rink for the draft and enthusiastically cheered when McKenna was picked. "I love those fans already," he said. "It's one of the most passionate fan bases out there. So I'm looking forward to getting started, and I can't wait to see what the future holds." You've been listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Remember, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Music is Land Back by Hallucination. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode.